Indianapolis City Hall at onlinekfai.org. And you're listening to...
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired.
You are listening to Fresh Air Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and 106.7 in St. Paul. This is Health Notes from the Hearts of a Natural Woman.
This program will inspire you, inform you, feed you healthy recipes, engage you politically, enlighten you spiritually.
Help me name it. I'm no longer doubtful of what I'm living for. And if I make you happy, I don't need to do more. Cause you make me feel. You make me feel. You make me feel like a natural.
Good evening. You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, and we're streaming online at kfai.org. And this is Health Notes from the Hearts of a Natural Woman, and I'm Kinshasha. Our conversation this evening is about grief. It's about ritual. We're talking with Francis Weller about his new book, Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. Good evening, Francis. How are you?
Good evening, Kinshasha. Thank you. I'm doing very well today. And you?
I'm well. And this is a conversation that is so important. Your book has forced me to look at grief in ways that I have not before, and I appreciate your work. It's so profound yet so simple. I think that we had better start by trying to get some definitions. You said grief, ritual, and the soul of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to us what that means.
If we look at grief as part of our long story as a species, it has always been communal and primarily addressed through the auspices of ritual. I mean, our oldest artifacts that we find are in sites around the world are often burial sites dating back 40, 50, 100,000 years. Those seem to have been the first inklings of something related to mystery, to the sacred, to that incredible experience that we notice when someone dies. Something leads. And so I think ritual is the means by that has evolved probably even before we had language to speak to these deep, sacred moments in our life. And the soul of the world is a very ancient thought, which is that there is a presence that permeates all things, the green world, the animal world, the mountains and rivers. Everything is imbued with a quality of soulfulness, and collectively it's been spoken to as the soul of the world. And part of, I think, our deepest grief that we carry is that we've been separated from that. We have been cut off in this very mechanized culture and very superficial culture in many ways from these deeper truths. So one of the griefs I encounter in my work with people is this feeling of dislocation, alienation, isolation from that larger story that we came here to actually feel and touch and participate in.
It's really interesting because we've destroyed rituals in this society.
Yes, we have.
From what I've read in your work and what my own noticing has been, is that it kind of keeps us closed up so that we don't ever really feel or experience, so that we don't get hurt, is what it looks like to me.
I think that's very good. I think that's very accurate. We're a culture that's very big on control, including controlling our emotions. And I think there's an instinct or an intuitive knowing that ritual takes us into places where we can sometimes be taken to a place where we're out of control, where emotion rises and takes us over. And we need times like that. In the book, I talk about one of the gifts of ritual is that it allows for moments of derangement because the current arrangement isn't working. And we need to be rearranged at times to get into a closer proximity to how the soul wants to live our life. And that's one of the most beautiful parts of ritual, but it's also scary. And if we're not raised in that familiarity of that context, we avoid settings like that. I make a distinction between ritual and ceremony. We need both, but ceremony is what I call the horizontal plane, where you go to events like a graduation or an inauguration or something, and it reinforces the bonds socially, which is beautiful. We need that. But we also need that vertical access, which allows us to drop into an alternate reality, some place where we can truly be shaken and rearranged. The culture, again, has a way of constantly pushing us into a form that's not kindred to our own soul. It's not indigenous to who we are. And we begin to match rhythms and patterns that do not feel right for us. And ritual is one of those means whereby the original pattern can be reinstated.
I want us to talk about grief a little bit. Usually when we think about grieving, we think of a loved one dying.
Yes.
And in this society, grief is something that we do alone as it relates to death, with the exception of the ceremony of the funeral that people do for one day, and then that person or the loved ones go individually and work out their own grief, and that's that pretty much. Maybe folks are bringing by food or whatever. It's really funny because even in the grief of and the sorrow that we feel from losing loved ones, we don't allow ourselves very much of that either, let alone all of the many other kinds of grief that there are.
Right.
And you talk about it from, well, as opposed to me introducing that, will you talk to us about the various kinds of grief that there is?
What you say is, again, very accurate. The only grief that really is honored in this culture, even partially, is when we lose someone or something we love. And again, that grief is even still very attenuated. It's brief. And you struck on something so important, Natasha, which is that it's very private. And this is one of the most damaging things that has happened to us in this culture, is the privatization of grief. I talk about the five gates of grief in my book. Those gates slowly became apparent to me over the course of leading many, many grief rituals. And they kept emerging as thematics that needed to really be named. And so I'll just briefly name them, and if we want to go further, we can. But the first gate, as I mentioned, is the gate that has to do with losing someone or something we love. And the second gate has to do with those parts of ourselves that have rarely, if ever, known love. In other words, when we are raised in families and in cultures and go through educational systems and religious systems that are very particular in what they allow, huge portions of our being are cut off and dismissed and disowned. It could be anger, it could be sexuality, it could be pleasure, it could be your joy and enthusiasm, your creativity, your sorrow. Any part of us can be cut off and lost, pushed to the margins of our life. Now, this is a loss to the integrity of the psyche, and the proper response to any loss should be grief. But we often hold these parts of ourselves with judgment and contempt, and we cannot grieve for something that we hold with contempt. So we have this kind of chronic feeling of grief following us around from this lack of welcoming. The third gate of grief is the grief of the world. Almost every day we're driving on the roads and we see victims of our machinery on the sides of the road, the raccoons and the foxes and the deer, and the roadkill is there every day, let alone the enormous damages being done to through mountaintop removal or clear cuts of forest or damming of rivers or overfishing of populations of fish. These are the sorrows of the world, and they are felt somehow in our being because we are not separate from the world, are we? We are contiguous with the entire integrity of the planet. Its sorrows are felt in our psyches somehow. I mean, I don't know anybody right now who can be fully immune from that overwhelming presence of loss of species and water and so forth. The fourth gate is a difficult one to name, but it's always there, which is, I call it the gate that has to do with what we expected and did not receive. This traces back to how we were shaped as a species over 1 million to 2 million years. That shaping is in our psychic anticipation, but also in our biological, emotional expectations. We expected when we arrived here to be received into a village. We expected when we got here to participate in the gathering of food and sitting around the fire at night and sharing stories. We expected to wake up in the morning and come out and see 40 pairs of eyes staring back at us and with curiosity about, what did you dream last night? Come, tell us. And to sit around and to do ritual together, to grieve together, to celebrate together. This was the anticipation in all of our beings, and almost none of that materialized. And it feels like this background fog. And the worst part about this grief is we often blame ourselves for its existence. Like, what did I do wrong that the village didn't materialize? It's a powerful grief. And then the last gate of grief is ancestral grief. And this is a profound grief in many ways, and it has many different facets. One of them is that no matter where we came from, at some point we came from an intact indigenous culture, whether it's European, African, Asian or whatever, if we go back far enough, we go back to an ancestral land that was connected to place, to song, to ritual, to food, and all of that got ripped away at some point. Some by choice, some by necessity, some by theft, stolen from their land, as you know well. And this is a deep ancestral wound, and it shows up in our beings as well. And then when particularly the European ancestors who came here, we carry another layer of grief to what we did to the indigenous people here, slavery, all these things are still filtering through our collective psyches as a grief that needs to be honored and acknowledged. And hopefully through that process, the heart gets to be redeemed to some degree so reconciliation can proceed. Those are the five gates of grief, and we all carry all of those all the time. And without any means by which we can address those communally, it becomes this great weight that just kind of drags us down day by day. Most of the people who come into my practice as a psychotherapist come in with complaints of depression. And as I sit with them for any length of time, what it really is oppression. They're feeling a great weight of unmetabolized sorrow because they have no place to take it. And that's because of what I mentioned before about private pain. We carry our pain so privately.
Tune in on Tuesday, October 7th for 24 hours of special programming, KFAI's Celebrating Latina Culture, featuring all of your favorite KFAI Latina programming, as well as emerging voices coming from the Twin Cities local Latina community. It starts at midnight on Tuesday, October 7th. Your favorite Tuesday regular programming will return on October 14th. A schedule will be posted online at kfai.org.
We're talking this evening with Francis Weller. His book, Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. As I listen to you and I feel what you're talking about, whether it's from the standpoint of being an African American, I remember the first time that I went, the second time that I went to Africa, when I went to Ghana. I went to Senegal and I didn't have this experience, but when I went to Ghana, I did. It was like 6 months before we were to go, the ancestors started talking to me and started telling me what I needed to bring and what ritual to prepare for. I had no idea of what it was, but I never questioned it. I did everything that they told me to do. And when I got to, when we got to the slave castles, actually, is where all of those things came in and where the ritual was to happen and to leave. It was a, and that particular ritual, I was told was, although I was in the slave castle with several people, that particular ritual was for me to do alone with the ancestors, which I did. And it was very, very deep and very, very powerful. It was very emotional, but more inward than outward. And what I did all the way to the slave castle is that I wrote down the names of all of my family members, all of my lovers, all of their family members, everybody that I could think of. I had like 3 pages of names, both sides, that I wrote. And when I was writing it, I didn't know what it was about or for. And as I got towards the end of the ritual, I read every single name that I had written down. And then at the end of reading the names, I just said that all of the hate and the violence and the anger, it started here. I leave it here. I will not go back to America with it. It's done. And when I finished that, I immediately saw a gold circle, a large gold circle that was like a half moon. And I just kept on watching it and watching it and watching it. And it slowly closed. And then when it closed, it was done. It was complete.
Beautiful.
And that's the first time that I remember the ancestors speaking to me in that way. I have certain family members and community members that we do certain things, especially with children, but it's such a challenging experience for us to really fully experience our feelings because we are taught to be so contained. Even in the best of times, Francis, we don't even get to really fully experience our joy, let alone experience our pain. And so the things that you're talking about, we have no frame of reference for. How do we begin to do this?
That's an excellent question. I would want to just first thank you for sharing your story. It was beautiful and touched me very deeply.
Thank you.
I love how willing you were to trust what you were told from that deep inner world of the ancestors. I think that's a good place to begin, isn't it? I mean, just to know that we are not alone and that both what I call the indigenous soul, what Maladoma has called the indigenous soul as well, and our deep ancestral memory stream can help us intuit our way back to sanity, about how to invite two, three, four other people to come together and break the taboo and say, tell me about your sorrows, and I will tell you mine. And it isn't about trying to fix them. They don't need fixing. What they need is room to be heard and responded to, and to have eyes of reflection that look at them and treat them with respect and regard. There's a beautiful little poem by Denise Levertov. She said, to speak of sorrow works upon it, moves it from its crouched place, barring the way to and from the soul's hall. So in order to clear that passageway between our soul and another, we need to speak of sorrow. We need to be willing and courageous enough to say to someone today, just today, I'm sad. I'm looking at the headlines in the paper. I'm looking at our community. I'm looking at our neighborhood. I'm looking at the children. I'm hearing about the salmon disappearing. And how could we not acknowledge that sorrow? If we don't acknowledge sorrow, we also simultaneously will close the access to joy. William Blake, that wonderful fiery poet in the 17th, 18th century, said that the deeper the sorrow, the greater the joy. But if we eliminate the territory of sorrow, we also eliminate the territory of joy. And what we've done in this culture is substitute excitement for it. So we have stimulants and stimulation. We've got bungee jumping and race cars and stock markets, lottery systems. We're trying to feel like we still have a pulse rather than the authentic experience of joy, which is the other hand in the prayer between grief and gratitude, between grief and joy. They are the two hands of prayer of our lifetime. They are inseparable. But if we deny one, we definitely deny the other. So I think what you're asking is how. I think we have to begin to become courageous and gather in small circles of people and begin to speak truth about what it is we all carry. Do you know anyone who has been spared loss?
No. Let me ask you a question about the drum. Where does the drum fit into this conversation?
The drum, for me, is used in every ritual that I do. It is the backbone of the ritual. It is the kind of like the carrier wave or the signal wave upon which the rest of the village and the ritual rests. So when the drum beat is strong and maintained through the whole ritual, this is what kind of keeps propelling the movement, the rhythm. It's what calls out of our whole emotional bodies the movement of the emotion towards the shrine. I'll tell you a quick story. I write about it in the book, but I was teaching a class in Oakland some years back, and it was a class that was filled primarily by priests and nuns on sabbatical. So they were all in their 60s and 70s, and I was teaching a class called Reclaiming Our Indigenous Soul. And I began with drumming, and I invited them all to stand and move around and dance, and they did. And after the drumming was done, this elderly nun came up to me and says, may I speak to you for a while? And I said, I'd be happy to come down early next week. And she said, well, can we do that today? And I said, oh, let me make some calls and check it out. And it worked out fine. And we sat down in this little room. And she said, when you began drumming, some old memory in me came flooding to the foreground. It was about when I was 15 years old and that I had just joined the convent. And after 2 weeks there, my father died. And she said, the Mother Superior called me into the office and said, well, you can go to the funeral, but if you go, you can't come back. And if you stay, you cannot cry. So she said, I chose to stay and didn't cry. But when you started drumming, all that feeling came flooding to the foreground. What can I do with this? So But I told her, I promise you that in 2 weeks we will do a grief ritual together, but next week we need to, you know, let everyone know what we're doing and prepare everyone for the ritual. So we did that. The next week we gathered and started sharing, and my God, the stories that poured out of these nuns and priests and other people that were there were just staggering. How much grief we carry, every one of us, waiting for that permission. Tell me your story. Tell me what you carry. And then the next week we did the ritual, and this 75, 78-year-old woman just rushed to the shrine and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed for her father, which she has been holding on to for 60 years. Mm. Powerful, powerful things happen when that drum enters the room. Great question. I've never been asked that question before.
I have a cousin who is in hospice, and I just received a text as far as helping with funeral costs. And my immediate thought is, how can I help my family, not just for me, but for all of us? And we want to start creating community and ritual around our loved ones passing. How do we introduce this? How do we become facilitators of this new way of being?
Mm-hmm. Well, we can keep it. I think a good thing is to keep it very simple at first. I don't think we have to make ritual very complex. It just has to be a strong enough space through which those more difficult, more potent emotions like grief can enter. We had a man die who was part of one of the men's initiation circles that I facilitate. A young man, 47 years old, a wife and a two-year-old child. He had been Catholic, so there was a Catholic mass, which was very touching and very moving. But what the members of his clan did, his brothers, was to the following week hold a sunrise to sunrise all-day fire ritual for him and invite anyone from the community to come and just be together to talk about this man who died. And it was beautiful. Again, very simple. They just kept this fire going for 24 hours and had a little shrine there with pictures of John. And it was just an invitation to come and actually allow the feelings of loss to be in community. And it was very gentle, very simple, but it also invited an extended period of time to mourn together, to really be together, to lean on one another. And that's part of it too, isn't it? That grief is such a potent emotion, and it drags us to our knees quickly. And so we need to be able to feel held and supported, cared for. When I was in Africa, I got to witness some of the funerals there, and they're amazing. They last 3 days. The whole process, people move in and out of these various stages of participation, from being a wailer and a real griever to people there to help hold the family as they're grieving, to dancing, to drumming, to just witnessing, to eating, to sleeping. And you cycle in and out of all those states throughout the whole process. So you feel and participate in all of the various elements of community grieving. Very simple gestures that invite those more sequestered emotions to come to the foreground is crucial, particularly around when there's been a death, is to get permission. We've kind of gone even further away from genuine funerals to having these memorials where we simply remember the life of the person who died, which are beautiful, but they frequently are not very welcoming of grief. We don't even get to weep. We're there to tell stories about the person. Again, a very wonderful thing, but what about our genuine grief, our real loss? Part of what I love about Maladoma's village is that they have a belief that says that the soul of the one who's died cannot get to the land of the ancestors without a river of tears. So, again, whether that's true or not, I think it is, but whether it's true or not, it gives tremendous permission for the village to weep. And there's something so sane about this. I remember walking up to one woman there and said, "You have so much joy." And her response was, "That's because I cry a lot." I thought, that's the most un-American phrase I think I've ever heard. It was so beautiful and so poignant and so truthful. And I thought, well, here's Blake in Burkina Faso. Here it is, grief, you know, sorrow and joy right there back to back.
For a lot of reasons, Francis, from the time that we were children, we stopped our tears.
Yes.
Even as we start them, we edit ourselves. We allow ourselves a prescribed amount, and then we stop. The things that you're talking about will allow and requires a freedom that we know nothing about.
It's a muscle. It really is a muscle that we must build. I remember it took me 3 grief rituals before I shed my first tear. I was a well-packed white man. Now, I kept it tight. I was in control. I could not let it go. But my God, did I know I had a lot of grief in me. So I was trustworthy enough of my internal feeling states to keep showing up to these rituals, but nothing would come. I'd watch people wailing and on the ground sharing their feelings, and I couldn't get there. Because exactly what you're talking about, that self-control, that almost that self-consciousness of, you know, being mindful of what will people think, or I need to be in control, or my feelings are not welcomed here. All of that conditioning interferes with the free movement of our emotion. So here we have to practice great self-compassion and acknowledge the fact that, yeah, this is not something I easily do or readily do, but it is something I can relearn to do. If the community can be gathered, so even again, there's like 4 or 5 people, if we can gather and grant each other the permission to not judge, to not even comment on another person's tears, we can slowly begin to rebuild the muscle that allows us to, when we are called to grieve, to weep, to let our tears flow. But it is absolutely a relearning. Well, first an unlearning, and then a relearning of what is indigenous to us. And grief is so much, well, it's part of what I call the commons of the soul.
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue presenting Cuckoo Wednesday, October 22nd. Cuckoo returns to the First Avenue stage with his latest release, Brighton.
It's an album that mixes Latina boleros and música romántica to pay homage to the brown-eyed soul that reflects Cuckoo's Chicano roots.
More information about Cuco at First Avenue is available at first-avenue.com.
We all will share loss, and the proper response to loss is grief. The proper expression of grief involves outrage, tears, and the need for others to be there with us. And so that self-consciousness slowly can begin to ease off of us as we begin to feel the blessing that comes out of that mutually entered space. When I can't tell you how I am, I'm sure you know, that experience of being side by side with another human being in grief is so healing. It is so nourishing and affirming to my soul that this is how we are meant to be. We are meant to be doing this together, side by side. And that's why I think every time we do the rituals, even for people who have never done it before, they come away saying, I recognize this. This is part of who we are. This is part of how we have always lived. And to grant that permission back to us is something that I think is very healing to the soul.
Is it possible for us to begin to create those rituals for each other right now, even before we lose someone, just for the suppressed grief that we have inside of ourselves?
I think that's essential. There was a woman who came to a grief ritual some years back who was very near death. She called me and said, and asked me, what would I get out of this? Someone recommended I come. I can't specifically know, but what I would imagine is that you may have things that you're still carrying, maybe some of the losses from having cancer for this long have affected how freely you've been able to live your life, or there may be many losses associated with this. And she just stopped and says, there are so many losses attached to this. And so she came and just let herself fall into this ritual, which we do over 3 days. It's not just a ritual. We really build the ground to get to our grief. She came away from that ritual saying, this is one of the most powerful things that's ever happened. I finally got to acknowledge the loss of my partner from my cancer, the loss of my career. You know, I didn't ever had children. I mean, all these different things, the loss of her breasts. I mean, all of these things are a consequence of this illness, but now you're just dealing with the illness. But what about all of the grief attached to it? So now she says, I feel ready to move on, whether that's to death or to maybe more years of living. But I think that's what you just asked is, I think it's so important that we give ourselves and the person who is facing death a chance to really release, address, free themselves from what they're carrying. I really hope that can happen.
In an important conversation with Francis Weller, we're talking about his book, Entering the Healing Ground, Grief Ritual and the Soul of the World. You know, Francis, I'm just wondering about your story.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you get to this place? How did you come to understand this? And in your book, you're called a soul activist.
Yes.
Tell us your story and tell us about being a soul activist.
Well, I often say I didn't volunteer for the position. I was drafted. In other words, loss has been a part of my life for as long as I can remember. Early on in my life, my father died and several other significant people in my world died. Moving away from my family in my early 20s and coming out to California and just, I think then that other layer of loss and that second gate around, I lost so much of myself over the course of that time trying to fit in, trying to be a good boy, trying to mm-hmm. please others. And there has been a slow diminishment in my own vitality and my own aliveness. And in the meantime, I was, you know, becoming licensed as a therapist and began sitting with people and noticing that common chord that struck through almost everyone's story about loss and grief. And up until the mid-90s, I didn't know what to do with it. And then I happened to meet Maladoma and took a year-long training with him and Sabonfu at the time. And that unleashed. It's like once I was in a village setting, it unleashed this grief that wanted to be acknowledged. And simultaneously, not only just unleashing it, but learning some new forms, some new ways to hold it, which was ritual. And then beyond that, Maladoma and I started teaching together for quite a few years. And everything we did, no matter what the theme was, the background was this deep ache in the psyches of people from this culture for community, for belonging, some sense of being able to participate in something that they knew was their birthright. So the more I sat with these circles, began offering grief rituals in 2001, that theme has just been percolating now for the past 14, 15 years, and it keeps getting deeper. I've recently begun teaching and co-leading week-long cancer retreats at Commonweal with Michael Lerner. And those have been extremely powerful times to be in the presence of people facing that ultimate question of our own disappearance and what do we need to do to acknowledge the grief that comes from the unlived life that we all carry. So that's kind of a thumbnail synopsis of my own story around this. It's been ever present. And at the same time, I feel more alive now than ever. I feel that by working with this territory, I have found some new sense of joy and connection and participation in my life that I didn't know was even possible. Because I always carry that background feeling of loss and grief. And until we really address that, it will feel like our lives are carrying around an extra weight that really inhibits that sense of joyful participation.
Certainly, in terms of the various kinds of healing work that I participate in, there's a sentence in your book that I found so familiar in any of the work that I do, and I work diligently to create environments of safety so that people can do their healing work.
Yes.
And you talked about that in terms of grief. How do we create that environment of safety?
Well, that's a very important question, and I think that's the work that comes with familiarity, that, first of all, we all know the territory. We all come to those gatherings touched by loss. And so the first thing is to recognize the commonality, that we are all in this boat. We all share this experience of loss and sorrow. But to create safety means that we are willing to suspend for the time being our obsession with fixing and repairing and trying to make right. And what we do is we enter into a space of welcoming. In that space, the psyche feels less anxious about having to defend or explain the ways in which we have suffered. If there's something that happens in the obsession with repairing and healing and fixing that sometimes makes us have to defend our experience. And what we're waiting for are spaces where there's no need to explain. I understand. You have had loss. You have suffered. No further questions. Your tears say it all. That's part of what we're waiting for. And you mentioned that thing about soul activism. That's really why I do this. I want to help protect the commons of the soul, as I've said before. I want to help make spaces where our souls can touch one another. And in that communion, we are granted permission to show up as we are, without the facades, without the masks, without the "I've got it all together" type of defense, but to say, no, today, in my heart, I am broken. I am feeling so much grief, and I need companionship, because as we know, we really can't let go of grief in private. There is a need. Even your story was so beautiful because the ancestors were with you. You know, you were not alone, were you?
Mm-mm.
You were deeply accompanied in that time with that ritual. And we are waiting for the arms of the others, whether they're in that spirit body or in this body, that can be the ones containing me while I grieve, so I'm not doing both jobs simultaneously. Because if I'm doing both, I can't really release my grief. I'm going to be caught in the obligation of containment. So to create that safety, we need to be willing to be great, non-judgmental containers for one another's sorrow. And then that gives me permission to go to my knees and let it go.
My goodness, what a powerful conversation. What important work. Do you have a website that our listeners could go to?
I have two. One of them would be the more general work that I do. That would be www.wisdombridge, one word, wisdombridge.net. And more specifically on the grief work would be enteringthehealingground.com. And I'd be happy to hear from any of your listeners if they have questions about grief work. There's a quality to your listening and to your questions that has pulled a lot out of me, and I'm just so grateful to you.
You have provided confidence and a bottom for me that I needed. Thank you so, so very, very much.
When we lose a loved one to death or in a long-term relationship, it is perfectly normal to grieve. We must honor and recognize each stage of the grief and every emotion we have. There will be shock, denial, anger, confusion, fear, helplessness, numbness, and eventually acceptance. There will be a point when we do not know what to do, but we want to do something. At that point, we must understand and accept that there is no death, there is no end, there is only transformation. Our loved one now exists in a new time, a new place, a new reality, and so do we. The relationship as we knew it has transformed from the physical to the spiritual, from marriage to separation, from loveship to friendship. It has not ended. It has changed. When we allow ourselves to grieve, we release the negative thoughts and emotions that make it easier to accept the change. When we do not grieve, we get stuck. Grief is natural and normal and to be expected. We owe it to ourselves and the memory of the relationship to grieve and cleanse our soul. Affirmation: I will take the time to grieve and prepare myself for the change. That comes from the book Acts of Faith, Daily Meditations, Yandla Van Sant.
You have heard it here. You have heard it there. You have heard it everywhere. Exercise is good for you. Not just for your muscles and your bones, but for pretty much every part of you. And that includes your brain. It is well researched and accepted that exercise is good for the structure and function of your brain. Studies have shown that just a few months of moderate exercise helps your brain create new neurons, boosts brain processing power, improves memory, and raises your overall state of well-being. The question then becomes, how long does that last? Most of us know if you stop exercising, the benefits that exercise provides your heart, lungs, and muscles starts to go away relatively quickly. However, is it the same with the brain? Researchers have taken on this question. By studying rats, researchers know that exercise helps our brain. One of the areas of our brain that gets a boost is called the hippocampus. The hippocampus is the memory center of our brains. Using special dyes, scientists were able to track what happens in the hippocampus with exercise. And maybe, more importantly, what happens when exercise stops. They took two groups of healthy mice. One was allowed to happily run on their exercise wheel. For the other group, the scientists locked their exercise wheels so they couldn't be used. They then tested their memory by using a pool maze. The pool had a platform that allowed the rats to get out of the water once they made it through the maze. After initial testing, the exercise group had a far better memory of the maze than the inactive group. Then, the researchers did not allow any of the rats to exercise. These rats were placed into three groups. One group tested after 1 week, another at 3 weeks, and the final group at 6 weeks. The researchers found that after only 1 week of inactivity, the rats that exercised were much faster in the water maze than those who did not exercise. Also, when they looked at their memory centers, the exercise rats had twice as many neurons than the inactive group. However, as the weeks went on and the rats didn't exercise, their recall skills faded and their memory center shrank. This suggests that just like how our muscles shrink and strength diminishes without exercise, so do the benefits that occur in our brains. This research backs up previous research that looked at rats who exercise compared to those who have not exercised. With the exercise group, their memory centers had more neurons and their ability to complete mazes was far better than the inactive group. However, after just 10 weeks, their brains and skills were nearly identical to the group who never exercised. There you have it, yet another reason to exercise, as if you needed one. This has been a Health Note by Dr. Jonathan Arnold of Arnold Chiropractic and Acupuncture.
On Tuesday, October 7th, for 24 hours of special programming, KFAI's Celebrating Latina Culture, featuring all of your favorite KFAI Latina programming, as well as emerging voices coming from the Twin Cities local Latina community. It starts at midnight on Tuesday, October 7th. Your favorite Tuesday regular programming will return on October 14th. A schedule will be posted online at kfai.org.
From Minneapolis's historic West Bank, you're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. We're streaming and archived on KFAI.org. It's where community has always grown.
I mean, this is not the kind of music that comes from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
No.